Hi, this is Emily Detweiler, CEO of KCBS, and you are listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts.
Music's podcast, and you're listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts, and I know it's one of yours too. The only problem is, after I get done listening to it, I'm hungry. All right, guys, take it away.
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen. Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen. But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all?
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Welcome to episode number 115 of a very special holiday Christmas Day episode of Baseball and BBQ. I am here with the person who can guide your sleigh, none other than Santa Claus, Jeff Cohen.
And here's my elf, Leonard Averman. Leonard, how are you doing? We have a gift for our listeners.
We do have a gift. And that's why I said on the other episode, Jeff, as long as I'm not the Grinch, I'm okay. Although I think the Grinch is misunderstood. I do. You know, but we can go into that. That's a topic for another podcast. But yes, you're right. This is a special gift for our listeners. We've got two great guests on this episode. Baseball and Barbecue. If you like them, you're going to love it, because we've got the author, Joe Posnanski, The Baseball 100. Jeff?
This book is an amazing book. It's a heavy book, more than 800 pages, and he chronicalizes his top 100 players in baseball ever. Not just the major leagues. He goes into the Japan leagues. He goes into the Negro leagues. The best 100 players ever. Most of them you'll agree with, and some of them you'll take exception to, but doesn't matter because it's a good read.
Yes, and before we start to even talk about it at all, even more, because I wanted to say something, we also have for our barbecue guest, none other than Chris Schaefer of Heavy Smoke Barbecue. And Jeff, tell us a little more about Chris.
Chris's team, called Heavy Smoke BBQ, was the 2021 KCBS Invitation Open World Champion. I mean, that says it all.
Not too shabby. And we had so much fun with, I'm laughing now because I'm thinking about it. We had so much fun with Chris. At some point we got to release the video of that one, because that one has to be seen, I think, to really be appreciated, but you guys will know what we're talking about. But let's just talk right now about the Baseball 100, because we're going to start with that. Of course, he has 100 players on. You're going to hear in the interview, 100 players in the book.
And as I guarantee, we do not talk about all of them. That's for sure.
No. I think we did 99. No, the book is 830 pages. You're right. It is heavy. What's great about it is, first of all, he's not ranking them exactly. So, right. But you guys got to read it. You got to see what we're talking about.
Yeah, and that's why it's important to read the introduction. Because that tells you, and I will just let you in a secret. Look, my favorite player of all time is Tom Seaver. He wore number 41. Number 41 is associated with Tom Seaver, which is why he's ranked 41 in the book. But in most people's eyes, he should be ranked much higher than that.
Much higher. Yeah. Much higher. And I'm just going to say, Jeff, You are my favorite co-host that ever lived.
Oh, well, that's certainly a distinction that I accept. Thank you very much.
And you guys will understand when you listen to the interview what I'm talking about. So there's so much in that. If we had the ability, we'd still be talking to Joe Posnanski.
Exactly. I mean, right.
So it was great. So, Jeff, why don't we just jump right into it?
Here's Joe Posnanski. It's not every day you get an interview with the giant of their industry, but today we do. Joe Posnanski is number one New York Times bestselling author of 6 books, including The Soul of Baseball, A Road Trip Through Buck O'Neill's America, The Machine, Story of the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, and non-baseball books such as Paterno and A Secret of Golf. He has written for The Athletic, Sports Illustrated, NBC Sports, The Kansas City Star, has been named National Sports Writer of the Year in 5 different organizations, and is the winner of 2 Emmy Awards, and is a member of the Society of American Baseball Research, commonly known as SABRE. He currently writes at joeposnanski.com, and he's with us tonight to talk about his latest book, The Baseball 100. Welcome to Baseball and BBQ, Joe Posnanski.
Thank Welcome, you. Joe. Great to be here.
Joe, what a book. It is fantastic. But I have to warn people who are going to get, they have to read the introduction. They have to read the stats, the guide to the stats, because that was very helpful. Because the way it's written, it looks like you're ranking everybody. And when you get into the introduction, you find out it's really, I mean, yes, it's your ranking, but there's certain reasons why people have ranked some places. So please tell us why and how you got started with the book.
Yes. Wow. I've been working on this book, you know, for probably a decade or more, you know, but it's really been a lifelong pursuit, right? It's everything, my whole life of being a baseball fan and thinking about these players and thinking about what greatness is and trying to capture a little bit of what I love about this game. So it is a ranking. It is the 100 greatest players ever. It's a ranking, which obviously leads many, many, many people to yell at me, which is great. But for me, it's something more. I do talk about that in the introduction. I do talk about that. I've done a lot of interviews, which has been wonderful. And I've always tried to say that for me, this book it's my love letter to baseball. It is for me the why I love the game, told through the stories of the 100 greatest players ever in my list. So, you know, so you get a nice combination of things. So I've had so many people come up to me and say how much they love the book, how it's made them fall in love with baseball again, how it reconnected them with their father, with their mother, with their grandmother. I mean, it's all of that has been amazing and incredible. And then there are plenty of other people who come up to me and go, how could you possibly put Barry Bonds number 3 or Ken Griffey Jr. 49 and you're an idiot. And that's fun too. So it's been an amazing, amazing run.
Joe, when we speak to authors, a lot of times I get the fan in me comes out. I will gush. But for you, this is what I'm going to do. And this is audio, but people will have to, Jeff, describe what I'm doing.
Standing ovation.
Get, yes. Bravo. Encore. This is one of the best books, baseball books I have ever read. And we have been reading. We've been doing this now for almost 4 years. I mean, Joe, baseball and barbecue. This is a unique podcast. Okay. Yeah. With the two of those, I like to say we're the Reese's peanut butter cup of podcasts. They two things go great together. The other thing I always say is the authors do the heavy lifting and all we have to do is the reading. But in this case, we do the heavy lifting too, because this book is 830 pages.
That's right.
And I loved, and I can't say that I've loved everyone because, one, I have not finished the book yet.
Right.
And I'm okay with that because I love the fact that I have something to go back to and learn more about every player. The Baseball 100, I kept saying to Jeff, I can't wait to get him on. I don't know how long we're going to have with Joe, but I could talk to you for hours, and I'm wasting that time already. But the Baseball 100, Jeff pointed something out to me. I think it was Jeff. I mentioned I'm going through the book, and it's the Baseball 100. It's not, you don't say it's the MLB 100.
That's right.
Okay. It's the Baseball 100. And what that means is in this book, there are players who played in the Negro Leagues, which should get their recognition. We have had, it's so great when we go through these things. We see Bob Kendrick mentioned.
Yes.
He's been a guest on the show a couple of times. You have Sadahara Owen here.
That's
okay.
Right.
So, and then there are players that I've never heard of. And so, Joe, I could go on and on gushing. I'm going to stop. I'm going to let Jeff now have his time because I've used all mine up, but we're going to come back to me. But again, standing O, this book is one of the best baseball books I've ever read. Highly recommend it. Everybody must get this book. Thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. I mean, all of that is so meaningful to me. When you write a book like this, and it is 800, and when you count the index, it's close to 900 pages, and it's 3 pounds of book. When you write a book like that, you kind of hope that it reaches an audience, right? I mean, that you're really, really geeking out on baseball, and you're like, oh, is this going to find an audience? Are there enough really hardcore baseball fans out there that are going to love this book? And that's what you think as you're writing it. And then, the book comes out, and people, you find people like yourself who obviously, couldn't be a bigger baseball fan and couldn't be a bigger baseball literary fan, to hear that is incredible. To hear from people who say, I'm not a particularly big baseball fan, but I love this book, is incredible. To hear people say, I can't read the book because my 12-year-old daughter grabbed it before I could get to it, is incredible. So yeah, I mean, it's so much better than I even hoped. I had these big hopes when this book came out. Obviously, every time you write a book, you want it to be something really, really special. And it has been so incredible for me how this book has been received.
Absolutely, you're right. I mentioned the glossary of terms earlier, and it's very important to read this because I've been using, I'm an old school guy, batting average, RBIs, home run, and I know about base percentage and slugging percentage, but that slash line that you talk about, the batting average, on base percentage, slugging percentage, 300, 400, 500. That's a great baseline when you're looking through the book. I mean, I know what war is. I can't figure it out. So I take everybody's, position. And okay, now the war number is what it is because I have no idea.
He's an accountant. Joe, Jeff is a CPA.
And I also love a lot of these tidbits and stories that you never get from anywhere else. Like I'm looking right now at the Ozzie Smith chapter.
Sure.
He has 621 assists in a year. Never going to happen again. And you bring out because, well, there's not enough balls in play now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was an incredible number when he did it. I mean, he was the first one to get 600 assists in a season, but it was not this mind-blowing number that it is now. I mean, now because of strikeouts, because there are not so many balls in play, you could lead the league with 450 assists. I mean, we're talking the guy was having one or two more assists per game than the very best defensive shortstops in the game today. I mean, that really is incredible.
Absolutely. And also don't miss the footnotes. Again, such great stuff in here. Who knew Gaylord Perry had the same record as his brother at one time? That's amazing.
It might be my favorite tidbit in the book is that Gaylord Perry and Jim Perry for one day or 3 days or some ridiculous thing, but had the exact same career record. I mean, that's when you start believing that there's something bigger in baseball. I love that stuff.
Yes, me too.
Joe, there's 100 players mentioned. We could obviously touch upon so many of them. I want to try to get to things that maybe
other interviews are not going to ask you. I mean, I could certainly, Buck Leonard is mentioned, Pete Rose, Barry Bonds, Pedro Martinez. I mean, on and on and on. I think what people have to know is that you're going to find out whether you think you know a player, you're going to find out something. As I'm reading this, how did you, one, narrow it down to 100 players? Because I'm sure you had players, I think many. You even mentioned that some were outside of the. As I'm mentioning this now, I'm thinking of some other things that I want to ask you. But good thing I took notes. How did you get it to the 100 and feel comfortable releasing this book? Sure. I mean, I would have. Wait, I can't send this into the publisher yet. When did you finally, get to that 100? How did you do that?
It's a great question, because it's exactly what my mindset was going through. So I'll tell you that the final 10 on this list, so 91 through 100, I had 40 players for those 10 slots. And it was hard getting it down to 40, but I got it down to 40 players for those 10 slots. And there were certain players that I'm sure people can see on that 10 that had to be on there in my view. So now it's down to 6 slots and 5 slots and 3 slots. And I mean, it was brutal. That was by far people say, well, what about ranking the top end of this? And yeah, I mean, look, you make your choices and you go, right? There's no other way. But leaving players out, there's so many great players that I wanted to write about too, that, and it's funny because I say this in the book. I think I actually end the book with this. This book was such a, it's 100 players. And my wife, who watched me go through it all, she's like, what, you next time maybe the baseball 50, I mean, maybe that's a little smarter idea. But honestly, I wanted it to be the baseball 200 because there were so many players I wanted to write about. So it was very hard. Look, the way I came up with the list, just to give you a quick rundown on that, I started with the stats. I really did. I worked with a guy named Tom Tango, who invented the wins above replacement, that WAR that we were talking about earlier. And we came up with a formula that I really liked. It's a different formula than probably anybody else has used. And it brought together a lot of different pieces, but for me, there were 3 particular pieces that brought together. I wanted players who were well-rounded. That was really important to me. So I mean, there are players in here who are one-dimensional, but one great dimension, right? Like they were unbelievable hitters or whatever. But I wanted players, if I could find them, who did everything well. I wanted players that represented their time. And that's really where it gets to be tricky, because obviously how do you compare a Walter Johnson to a Pedro Martinez, right? You're talking about over many, many, many years, a different game in a lot of ways. But I wanted them how they compared to their time. That was important. And then I wanted players who were truly great, like they reached a peak of true greatness. I didn't necessarily want players who were very, very, very good for a long period of time, even though that's an incredible achievement and those people are in the Hall of Fame and they should be. But what I wanted were players who reached a very high peak. So that was how we started. And when we finished that formula, that's the easiest part, you have a list. And the list, we took it all the way down to 1,000, more than 1,000, where you could actually just rank them in order. I mean, and there they are. And it looks so clean when you do that, by the way, because it's so hard, later the efforts that I went through, it's like, boy, if I just stayed with that formula, it was all there for me right there, but that's where it starts. And then to me comes the hard part and the fun part, where you actually start saying, okay, look, this formula is great, but it's not everything. And I want to rank these players the way I want to rank these players. And some of the players that were in that original list of the 100 are not in the Baseball 100. Some of the players who are outside of that list are in the Baseball 100. And of course, that list didn't contain Negro Leagues players, like you mentioned. It didn't contain world players like Sadahara Oh from Japan, but also great players from Cuba or Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic from before the time they could play in the major leagues. So then you put that list together and then you start moving it around. And then But you couldn't have nailed it more on the head. There comes a moment where you have to say, that's my 100 right there. Because otherwise you could spend literally, you'll never finish it ever. Because every single day I would come in and go, no, I don't want that. I want that guy. And I want move that up and move that down. And you have to come to a point where at some point you're like, okay, that process is over. This is the baseball 100. And now comes the writing. So you really do have to almost, you know, just stomp on your own feet or something and just go, okay, enough. It's time to go.
Well, top 10, 20. I mean, nobody can quibble with you. You didn't need to do any stats with that. I mean, come on. You know, I'm not going to give anybody any secrets. Willie Mays, Babe Ruth, I would say
top 50. Top 50 are pretty easy.
Yeah.
I suppose if it was 50, it would be harder. Now suddenly 40 to 50 would be hard, right? Like you would have that issue.
Right.
But yes, I mean, I think I actually did this figuring once. There were something like 68 or 69 players who I never even considered not having them on the list. Like they were, you know, they were players that it's like, okay, guaranteed on the list. I mean, they're absolute no brainers. And there were probably another 10 or 20 that I thought, yeah, I mean, they're one of the 100 greatest players. It was really those last, you know, 15 to 20 where you're just like, yeah, this is, it could be any of these guys. All of these guys deserve to be on this list.
Yeah. And you have some people on this list that some people never heard of. And I'm going to say, you know, Oscar Charleston. We were lucky enough a couple years ago to interview Jeremy Beer, who you do mention in the book.
Yes.
About his biography on Oscar Charleston. And he was great. Great player.
Great. Yeah. And a great book. I mean, yes, it's interesting to me. There are Negro Leagues players in here, as you know, you mentioned a couple of them already, who people wouldn't know. Everybody knows Satchel Paige. Everybody knows Josh Gibson. Might not know Bullet Rogan, or might not know Pop Lloyd, or might not know some of these other guys that are in the book. Charleston is the weird one to me, because even within the confines of the Negro Leagues, he was always viewed as the greatest player. You know, they, you know, Gibson was the greatest hitter and Paige was the greatest pitcher, but Oscar Charleston was the greatest hitter. And yet for many, many, many years, nobody knew him. I mean, he really was unknown. Gibson was known and Paige was known, but Oscar Charleston wasn't. He came earlier than those guys did. He was, you know, a player who was, there were legends about him, but the legends weren't necessarily, you know, like Josh Gibson hitting a fly ball that never landed, or Satchel Paige, you know, striking out 27 batters and one town and then doing it again in another town and all of that. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's the one, because for me, the rankings could, as you guys saw, they're very fluid. I mean, to me, it's more of an art, I think, than science of just connecting players to numbers. That's what I wanted to do. But I wanted Oscar Charleston to be in the top five because I thought, one, he deserves to be there. He should be there. But two, because I thought that would jolt people and say, wait a minute, I've never even heard of this guy, or I know almost nothing about him. And that was part of what I wanted to do with that.
And you tell a story in the Oscar Charleston chapter where you, Willie Mays, is in the Negro League Museum and you talk about the catch. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember. I remember vividly him being there. And I remember vividly Buck O'Neill talking to him about, because there's a statue of Oscar Charleston in center field, and Buck O'Neill saying to Willie Mays that Oscar Charleston was you before you. Right. And Willie Mays saying, oh, I know who he is. Because when he was young, he was a great player. And everybody said, yeah, but he's no Oscar Charleston. I mean, that's really, he'd heard that all of his life.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think a week or so after Willie Mays made that famous catch in 54, that's when Oscar Charleston passed away.
That's 100% right. And I did think that was, you know, there were so many moments of, I don't know, kismet or something in this book where I remember that particular one. And this happened a lot when I was writing this book. So I'm writing about Oscar Charleston. I've got all this stuff. And then I see the date of his death and I'm, you know, writing about that. And I'm like, wait, 54, that's October of 54. That's gotta be right around the same time. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you start making those kinds of connections and suddenly they become a vivid part of the book.
there are a few ways you can read this book. So it starts at 100. And then if you go the normal way to read a book, the way we most people here read books, you go from 100 to 1. And it's very funny. And I said to Jeff the other day, what number are you up to or whatever? And he told me, and I said, oh, wow, you got far or whatever. But he started reading from the back of the book, the end of the book at 1 to the other way. And of course, there's one other way, which is just to grab the book, flip open a page and just read. So I joked with Jeff and I said, well, so you're actually reading it the Hebrew way.
That's right.
You're going, right. You know, back to front. Right?
I should have put a back cover. I should have actually had like you do. Right. At Hanukkah, at Passover, where you just have, you're looking through the back cover. Yeah.
And then what I thought about was, and we haven't really talked about it, and you mention it prominently, and actually in the introduction, you talk about your mother and her, where she, how she just came to the country and you were born 3 years later and she spoke Yiddish. And that's a funny, fascinating story. And then you talk about Mike Mussina and how the scouting report on him is he's a mensch.
Yeah.
So actually, based on your background, reading it from the end, from number one backwards, actually makes a lot of sense. So Joe, in my long-winded way of saying it, which I'm famous for, tell us more about you. Tell us your background, because even that's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I mean, I just never thought that was the life I was going to live. I mean, I ended up with this crazy, wonderful life. Hearing that you are a CPA is amazing to me, because I went to school to become an accountant, and which is what my mother thought I should do. Not taking into account my very limited skills and ability with numbers. And so, and I tell this story to kids, and it's 100% true. I remember vividly the day that I knew I wasn't going to become an accountant. I used to take the city bus home from college daily. I lived at home and I used to take the city bus home. And I remember this day. I was in the city bus and we passed a business park. And I was looking out the window at this business park, and there were all of these, people out there, and they all had they were smoking and they had these satchels and briefcases, and they were dressed up in suits. And I remember looking out the window and thinking, that's never going to be me. That's never going to be my life, where I'm going to be out there in that group. And coincidentally, that was the day I had failed out of accounting in college. So it worked out really well. It was like a nice, a nice way to have that timing. And I truly did go home. I had a typewriter and I wrote a bunch of letters to a bunch of different people who I thought had interesting jobs. I wrote to Bob Costas, was he was at NBC at the time. I found an address for him and wrote to him, and he wrote back. I wrote to other sort of celebrity types. I wrote to some local people who had jobs that seemed interesting to me. And one of the people I wrote to was the sports editor of the Charlotte Observer, where I was living, where I still am living again. I left Charlotte for 30 years and now we're back. But I wrote to the sports editor of the Charlotte Observer, a guy named Frank Barrows, and he wrote back and said, well, that we sometimes let, guys come in, women as well, come in and write little stories about high school teams. If you want to come in and cover a high school game for us, we'll pay you $20. We call them stringers. You could be a stringer for us. And I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. And $20, I needed it. And so I called and begged and pleaded, and he gave me an opportunity, and then he gave me another one and another one and another one. And I was scared to death because I loved it immediately so much. And I just thought, nobody had ever told me I could write. I had literally no knowledge whatsoever that I had any ability as a writer. I was scared to death. I wasn't good enough to do it. And I just vowed to myself, whatever I have to do to do this, because I love this so much. And wow, it worked out. And, you know, and then you, and then suddenly you end up, you know, being, being a columnist in Cincinnati and Kansas City, and you're working at Sports Illustrated, and you're traveling around the world, and you're writing books. And I literally have no earthly idea, you know, I mean, just to be the son of immigrants who came to this country just before I was born. And, you know, they didn't know anything about what it was to be an American, and just taught me to go after what I wanted. So it's unbelievable to me. I mean, it really is unbelievable to me that at the end of the day, I could be, you know, allowed to write an 830-page baseball book. It blows my mind.
And you did a fantastic job writing the book, obviously. I do have a couple of questions on some of the players in here. I thought I knew everything about the Pete Rose and the Pete Rose saga. And you know what? Turns out I didn't. I knew about the baseball rule, no gambling on your team, but I didn't know there was one, you can't gamble on another team. And it was two different punishments. And who knew that what possessed Pete Rose not to take that deal is unbelievable.
It's really amazing. And you know, boy, I'm glad you said this, because every one of these essays, I had two very, very strong thoughts in mind. One is, if they've never heard of this player, they don't know who it is. So if it's Archie Vaughn or it's Buck Leonard or it's Pop Lloyd or whoever it is, I want to make this so that they learn about the player and they like the player, they get to know the player. But I also wanted it, if you are a passionate fan of that player, that I give you something that you might not have known, you know, some way of looking at it. And I had written about Pete Rose forever. My second book was The Machine, about the 1975 Reds. I had written so much. And it was only by going back and taking a very, very close look at the moment when Bart Giamatti banned him forever, looking at that saga, which was very ugly, very ugly. It ended up being Rose suing baseball, suing the commissioner personally. The commissioner, you know, we all know what it did to his health. I mean, he you know, and he died shortly afterward, and it was very, very ugly. But what I did not know is exactly what you're saying. There are two rules. The rule is, if you bet on baseball, it's a 1-year suspension, and if you bet on your own team, it's a lifetime ban. So there are two different rules on the books, and it is very clear when you watch this thing go that Bart Giamatti just wanted to suspend him for a year. That's absolutely what he wanted to do. And he just wanted Rose to admit he bet on baseball. He was going to close the book on it. He was ready to go. He didn't want this black eye for baseball. Rose was such a beloved figure. He didn't want to be the one to knock him out. He certainly didn't want him to not go to the Hall of Fame. He didn't want any of those things. But Rose was so adamant and so combative and such a, you know, I don't know if he would regret it. I don't know if Pete Rose has regret, but he fought and fought and refused to admit even a single thing, which is how he lived and how he played. It's part of what made him such a great player, was his refusal to back down to anything. And because he didn't back down, the commissioner had no choice but to suspend him for life, and he'll never get back in. You know, he'll never get back into the game.
Right.
What? If you said you had two, so I'm not interrupting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Another one. I always knew Eddie. I didn't see Eddie Matthews play, at least in his prime, but I knew he was a great player. But I didn't know how great he was, looking at this list you had of a career home runs at progressive ages, and he was actually on pace higher than Aaron. Yes. And then, yeah, and that was, you know, unbelievable to me. And then around, what, age 31, 32 season, it flipped, and when Aaron became the greatest home run hitter, you know, who lived. So, yeah, that's just amazing.
Yeah, Matthews was so good so young. You know, he was – that's why he stayed ahead of Henry Aaron's pace for – you know, and they were teammates and great friends and very close to each other and all of those things. And Eddie Matthews was the manager for the Braves when – and Henry Aaron broke the record. So it was a very, but you're right. There were a couple of things that struck me about Eddie Matthews. And it's a guy that has, I wouldn't say he's been forgotten, but I don't think people talk about him anymore very much. Eddie Matthews, to me, there's no question when he retired, he was the greatest third baseman in baseball history. You know, since then, Mike Schmidt has come along and George Brett and Chipper Jones and Adrian Beltre and so on and so on. But when he retired, he was the best. But nobody viewed him as the best. And, you know, that's a big story I talk about in the book, how Pye Trainer ended up being named the third baseman of the all-time team in 1969 and not Eddie Matthews, and how ridiculous that was. So he was always underrated, and then he just kind of kept on being underrated. And he was not always an easy guy. You know, he was not always somebody that was, you know, he didn't love the media by any stretch and so on. But you're right. What a great, great player he was, and underappreciated for how great he was.
Exactly. That's what I thought after reading it. Very underappreciated.
Let's go back to your mom for a second. Okay. Yeah. Your mom may have been an immigrant and may have not known anything about baseball, but you point out something. Your mother was against the designated hitter. And so some people will side with her and some people won't. But your mom wouldn't have approved of his position.
I remember it's like it was yesterday. And it's funny because she's read this book. My mother knows nothing about baseball, cares nothing about baseball. That's never changed. And it never will change. But she read this whole book and really, really liked it, which in some ways is going to be the greatest compliment I'm ever going to get, is because my mother, if she didn't like it, she would have told me that she didn't like it. But yes, she was the one who I first collected baseball cards with. She loved the idea of baseball cards. She loved organizing. That was her, still is in many ways, her thing. So she loved organizing, and baseball cards are perfect. They're perfect organization things because they have numbers, teams, positions. You can put them in any order you want. There's so many different things. And we were putting them in order of position. And the baseball cards used to say it was 76. And the DH, it said Dez hitter. It didn't say designated hitter. It didn't say DH. It said Dez hitter. And my mother says, what is this Dez hitter? And I said, that's a designated hitter. And she was like, well, what is that? And I said, it's a person who doesn't play in the field, but hits. And her immediate reaction was, that's stupid. Like, that was like her immediate reaction was, yeah, that's stupid. But as you guys have read in the book, my mother's most famous baseball quote is after I wrote my very first baseball story for the newspaper, she called me. And I was obviously very excited. It was my first baseball story. I'd written other sports, but not baseball. And my mother called me and she said, I read your story today. It's very good. And I said, thank you. And she said, I just have one question for you. Who are you to determine if a run is earned or unearned? And I've always held on to that as sort of something. Yeah, who am I to make that determination?
That's a great story.
Joe, you write a book like this. And the beauty of it is that everybody has an opinion. So we're all gonna have opinions, and you know right away when you're writing this that you're gonna invite controversy. But that's what you want. You want people to talk about it. I'm gonna say everything I'm saying is positive. I'm gonna say one thing.
Yes.
You have Mike Mussina in here as among the 100 greatest of all time. Okay, he is in the Hall of Fame, so I'm not going to argue it. What I am going to argue, though, is two things. One, at the end of the Mike Mussina chapter, you say, one of the greatest pitchers who ever lived. That I have an issue with. And then the other thing is, and this is, well, I'm married to an English teacher, and sure. I am a frustrated writer.
Yeah,
a frustrated writer. Sure. Probably why one of the reasons we do this podcast, you know, and I also I wrote, you know, at times for local papers and stuff. The expression "whoever lived." Well, I understand it's an expression, but as opposed to what? Who never lived?
Right.
That's a I great... just. And people will say, you know, Leonard, it's just an expression. Get over it. But I cannot. the greatest who ever lived, as opposed to what? Who? I know someone who's the greatest who never lived.
There you go. My friend, Jonathan Hawk, who I actually co-wrote, made the movie that they play at the Baseball Hall of Fame now. John is a great director, has done a bunch of 30 for 30s, and he did one on the greatest running back who never lived, who is a running back who never got to play in the NFL. And so, yeah, you're 100% right. Yeah, look, Mussina was definitely one of those players who, you know, is drawn, I wouldn't say controversy. I don't see it as controversy, by the way. I mean, I've had lots and lots and lots of arguments, but to me, that's what it's about. I don't see it as drawing, it's just my opinion. I mean, you know, it's like there's no controversy if somebody says to me, like, how could you leave Juan Marichal out of this book? Well, they're right, you know, but my only real response is, you know, you could write your own Baseball 100 and then you could put Juan Marichal in your book, but they're right. Juan Marichal belongs on this list. Of course, he's one of the greatest players who ever lived. Todd, you like that, how I just brought that in? But yeah, you can make arguments for all of these players. You can make arguments, this person is too high, too low. And I love that because the other thing about that is, I think baseball, more than any of the other sports, in my view, thrives on those kinds of arguments. I mean, yes, you have the Michael Jordan versus LeBron James in basketball. You have the Tom Brady versus whoever you want in football, but it's not the same. It's not the same as it is in baseball. Baseball so cherishes its history. It's so nostalgic. It's so romantic. And so when we're sitting there arguing about whether or not Ken Griffey Jr. would have been one of the 10 greatest players ever had he stayed healthy, that's the lifeblood of baseball, in my view. You know, that's exactly the kind. If you're watching a football game, if you're at a game, you are locked in and there are people around you or yelling at you and maybe hitting each other and pouring beer on each other or whatever. And I've been in all of those circumstances. But you're at a baseball game and you walk around, it's a bunch of people talking about, I got to see Brooks Robinson play, right? I remember Greg Maddux when he used to do this, or I was there when Sandy Koufax threw this, you know. And that to me is why baseball is one of the reasons baseball is so wonderful. And so I hope that all of that is in this book. And so, yes, it is. I say right at the beginning, I know you'll have disagreements. Let's go. Let's talk about them. Let's fight. Let's argue. It's because I think that's so much a part of baseball.
And my favorite player you have in the book, and he was so, and I can't believe he's so low on the list, but like I said, you had to read the introduction because he's listed at number 41. And yes. I was at that game when he went number 300 at Yankee Stadium. It was a great day. And you brought me back to that day.
That's awesome. Tom Seaver, 41. You guys know this because you've seen it and you've read it. When I say the numbers are more art than science, I really mean it. I mean, there are many, many players in this list, more than people even think. Like, people will say, oh, I noticed a couple. There are a lot of players on this list who are connected to a number rather than a ranking.
Exactly.
And some of them are controversial. I think the most controversial is DiMaggio. He's definitely too low if you're looking at purely as a ranking. But when I think of the number 56, I think of Joe DiMaggio. So to me, it's an honor that I wanted to give him, he gets the number. It's there. Nobody else should be 56. And I think it's the same way with Tom Seaver at 41. And you know, somebody said to me, so if Mike Trout was 41 and Tom Seaver was 27, would you just have swapped them? Is that what you would have done? And, you know, I just kind of shake my head because they're not those numbers. So I don't have to answer the question, but also, you know, I mean, what I tried, other than with DiMaggio, who I definitely moved quite a bit, every other player is within a couple of where they were anyway. It was just, so if I'm making Tom Seaver 36, you know, nobody's going to remember that, but I make him 41, his number, his moment. The other thought that I had for him was to make him 69 for the 69 mm-hmm. Mets. Right. It was too low. I can't make him number 6.
Right.
So 41 is, I'm happy. I'm happy with Tom Seaver. Yeah.
And apropos, when I read the Yogi Berra chapter, what you've done in research there and just going through those I guess, game little summaries that you picked out 12 game summaries of his. And yes. it wasn't good. It was all negative. But that was the only 12 times he struck out, which when you think about today, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's not even that's like a half a week for like Giancarlo Stanton. Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you one thing about this book that really helped me. I wrote a cover story about Yogi Berra for Sports Illustrated and did a ton of research and did a ton of work. And you know, and I spent time with Yogi, obviously, before he was gone. I was with him at the museum. He was wonderful and loved the guy. Okay. So now I'm doing a Yogi Berra. Now it's time for the Yogi Berra chapter in the book. I'm like, well, it's got to be completely different from what I wrote for Sports Illustrated. So everything that I wrote for Sports Illustrated, look, I'm going to pull pieces of it, obviously. But I'm like, what can I do about Yogi Berra that I haven't done before? Something completely new and different. And I noticed there's the year he struck out 12 times. And I was like, what if I did that? What if I literally found all 12 times that he struck out and built, you know, around his greatness, you know, to show how great he was. And, you know, I tried to do that with a lot of people. I mean, that was some of the fun, was the challenge of, say, how do you write about Roberto Clemente, or how do you write about Sandy Koufax, or how do you write about, you know, Johnny Bench in a way that has not happened before? And that's a fun challenge.
Yeah. And one last thing with Yogi Berra, though, and it's right. When you wrote, he didn't say everything he said. I'm just going to leave it at that, because there was a line in there, the film has a famous quote that I thought he said, and he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because so many of his quotes, even he didn't remember whether he said them or not. At some point, it's just like, yeah, it's not even worth fighting about. But his most famous quote is what I went to look for. And actually, I don't want to give it away. I know. I'm glad.
I don't either.
The quote he said, I think, is better than the quote he got famous for. So I'll leave it at that. Yes. I think
gotta get the book.
What he actually said was, I thought, even better.
Yes, got to get the book. I didn't want to ruin it either.
The book's The Baseball 100. We are speaking to the author, Joe Posnanski. And just, I'm telling you, Joe, as I'm sitting here and we're talking, this is like being in a candy store. It really is. What a treat. There is a number in the book that you do not mention, and you specifically don't mention it, but I'm going to mention it.
Yes.
And it's number 19.
That's right.
Why don't you tell us why you didn't put number 19, and how do you avoid putting number 19?
It occurred to me pretty late, actually. I mean, I think the list was basically done, and I started looking, and people will know that two of the greatest all-time players were 20. Mike Schmidt, Frank Robinson, both wore number 20. And that really intrigued me, that they both wore number 20. And I started to think to myself, I can only give one of them 20. Who would I give 20 to? Part of me says, all right, look, Mike Schmidt, you know, great fielder, great home run hitter, walked a lot, was just this, but Frank Robinson was this unbelievable hitter, won the Triple Crown. And I'm going back and forth, who's, you know, and they were right next to each other on the list, by the way. I mean, even on the statistical list, they were right next to each other. And I thought they're both number 20. There's no other answer for me because it really mattered to me to give people the number that I thought they deserved. That was really important to me. I had a really tough time with 24 because 24 was Ken Griffey Jr. and 24 was Ricky Henderson. And trying to figure out who should be 24 and who is not was tough. So I saw 20 and I said, you know what, they're both 20. And I thought, but how do I do that? And then I thought, you know what, no 19. Because of 1919 Black Sox. And I mean, it was just a moment where I, you know, and Shoeless Joe is not in this book. He was the one of the last, very, very last ones to get knocked out at the very end. And I thought, oh, this is a way to get Shoeless Joe in the book somewhere. You know, it's like if people notice that number 19 is not there, maybe they'll wonder why the heck there's no 19 in the book.
Joe, we really appreciate your time. We can go on and on hours for this. I do have one more question on talking about the great pitchers of the 60s and 70s. We talk about Seaver, Carlton, Palmer, Gibson. One that you have in the book that I guess maybe gets a little forgotten, but Fergie Jenkins. And when I read his chapter, Wow, 20 wins, you know, nine seasons in a row? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what an underrated and great pitcher he was.
And he's one of my favorites because I think even if you know Fergie Jenkins and know that he was this really good player, I don't know that you know why exactly. You know, with Seaver, it was so obvious, the perfect motion and the high fastball and all the strikeouts and everything else. And Carlton had the great slider and was this big lanky guy, didn't talk to the press, and Gibson obviously was as intimidating as they come. But what was Fergie Jenkins' thing? What was his deal? Why was he so good? I mean, he certainly had a good fastball. He certainly had good stuff. He had great control. But what makes him, like, separates him? And the answer is, you know, what I think the answer is in this chapter about the relentless nature of the way he pitched. He knew who he was, and he knew how he was going to get people out. And he did the same thing again and again and again and again. And, you know, there's a real greatness to that. And Fergie's still with us and is a wonderful guy. I actually just did they were doing a Ferguson Jenkins documentary for WGN. I was a part of, and, you know, he's only now in many ways beginning to get sort of some of the recognition and love. You know, we've lost Seaver, we've lost Gibson, you know, those guys from the 60s and 70s, they're not that many of them are with us anymore, the great ones. So now people are beginning to finally see, wow, Ferguson Jenkins, what a great pitcher he was.
Yeah, he had 3,000 strikeouts, less than 1,000 walks. Yeah. Only one of four pitchers who've done that. You know, it says Schilling, Maddox, and Martinez, and Jenkins.
Not a bad group to be a part of.
Yeah, exactly. Joe, again, we thank you very much. Where can people, you know, find you? I said joepoznanski.com.
Yeah.
Anywhere else, any other social media you have? And
I do have Twitter, Jay Poznanski. That's pretty easy to find. And yes, joepoznanski.com is where I do my writing now. And I would love if people would like to sign up. You can sign up. There's two different ways. There's a subscription site, but it's also free. Where you can get some free stuff. And I'm having a lot of fun. I'm actually counting down the 101 greatest football players there now. It's a much different project than the baseball one. But just for fun, we're trying it a little bit with football now.
I have a feeling Lawrence Taylor's on that list.
He might be. He might very well be.
Joe, I don't know. Maybe Jeff's trying to wrap up or whatever, but I am not letting you go yet. So I think... As you've probably are listening and see how we do this, Jeff manages to always get back to the subject at hand, and I kind of somehow move around.
Sure.
I had the thrill once of being in the Vatican, and I was on a tour, and the woman that was giving the tour said to us, she went to Mass every day or whatever, and she said to us, I was at a Mass, and the Pope, I forget who the Pope was at the time. I don't want to say the wrong Pope, and the Pope actually walked in or was there, and he would just come in and sit. And she said, and he shook her hand or I guess kissed her hand, whatever he did. So she said, this is the hand that touched the Pope, and she offered that hand. She said, I will shake your hand. This is the hand that, you know, touched the Pope. Well, I almost feel like that's with you. We are talking to the man who spoke to some people that we'll never get to speak to, whether, you know, because we are not the huge podcast, you know, that of some famous people, or unfortunately, because they've passed away. There is one person that you had the privilege of speaking with that Jeff and I both believe should be in the Hall of Fame, and that is Buck O'Neill.
Yeah.
And you had the honor of speaking to him, and we are speaking to you, but I would like to know a little bit about your relationship with him and just what it's like to speak to him, because I've heard so many amazing things about him and I just want to hear more.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, Buck was, there was never anybody like him. There never will be anybody like him. I mean, he was as a player, he was a great player in the Negro Leagues. He was a great manager in the Negro Leagues. He was the one of the first, maybe the first really prominent African-American scout in the major leagues. He was the first African-American coach in the major leagues. And he was this wonderful spokesman for the game. But none of those things capture who he was. I mean, he was someone, and I got to, you know, I got to not only speak to him, but you know, spend years with him, including my first book, where I just traveled the country with him. He was a great friend. And every single day I miss him and I think about him, because the thing about Buck was that he had, in my view, he had every right to be angry, every right to say, you know what, I didn't get the chance to go to Sarasota High School. I didn't get the chance to, you know, even try to play in the major leagues. I didn't get a chance to coach on the field. He was the first African-American coach in the major leagues, but they didn't let him coach first or third. They wouldn't let him on the field. I didn't get to manage in the major leagues. And he could have. He could have done all of those things. He could have done them brilliantly well. So he could have been angry. And I have to tell you, there was zero anger in him, zero bitterness in him. I saw it literally every day, every single day. Something would happen, and I would just see just the warmth and love that was inside him. It was incredible. And I always tell sort of the sad but inspiring story of the day that he didn't make it into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And he thought he was going to get elected. They had put together a panel of experts, Negro Leagues experts, to put in as many as they wanted. Essentially, they were given more or less carte blanche to put in, you know, and they ended up putting 17 people in to the Hall of Fame. All of them were deceased, long deceased in many cases, and they didn't vote in Buck. And it was, you know, at the time it was an outrage. A lot of people were very angry about it. But I was in the room with Buck when he found out that he didn't get in. And I remember I was very angry. Bob Kendrick, who was the person who told him, was very angry. But Buck wasn't. And Bob went downstairs to go sort of do a press conference, set up a press conference for Buck. And Buck turned to me. And he said, 17 got into the Hall of Fame, right? And I said, yeah, Buck, 17. And he said, I wonder if they're going to ask me to speak for them. And this is minutes after he found out that they didn't vote him in. And I was stunned. And I said to him, Buck, you would do that? You would do that, you know, for the Hall of Fame? And he looked at me and he said, son, what has my life been about? And he was right. That's what his life was about getting the recognition for those 17, telling the story, bearing witness to the Negro Leagues. And he did. He spoke at the, you know, because there was nobody else who could do it. There were no family members that, you know, there were a few, you know, but most of these players have been dead 50, 60, 70, 80 years. I mean, there was nobody who knew them. And Buck sang there and led, you know, led the crowd in song and spoke on behalf of those 17. And he died 6 weeks later. I mean, it was the last public appearance he would make. And I think about that story because I was writing my book, The Soul of Baseball, and I had saved the ending for when he got into the Hall of Fame. That was my thought, was he's going to get into the Hall of Fame, and that's going to be the perfect ending for this book. It's going to be the movie ending. I had, you know, the whole movie cast. I had it all worked out in my mind. And instead, he's there speaking on behalf of these 17, and I realized that was the real ending. You know, that's the movie ending was the one I wanted, but the real ending was, once again, him being told no and triumphing, you know, over that. And that's, so that's Buck O'Neill to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that story. That's a great story.
Jeff, I know we're going to wrap up. Joe, I hope that we could have you back because there's so many things. You wrote a book about the life and afterlife of Harry Houdini.
I did.
Right. I mean, you did the Hall of Fame movie where you traveled the country and got to interview all the players, which I have to tell you how envious I am of you after that. But, and we are respectful of your time, but I'm serious, Joe,
we could be talking to you. The sun could be coming up here and we could still be talking to you. You are, I know I'm gushing. I'm sorry, but you're unbelievable. And I hope that as you do all these numerous interviews with all these podcasts and, you know, these other, you know, they're not baseball and barbecue.
No, they're not.
All these other that you will remember that right here, you have two huge fans who just respect everything that you've done with this book and are very appreciative to you. So I hope you will keep that in mind because you're a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. No, it means a lot.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was incredible. We didn't even scratch the surface with Joe.
It's a great book. I mean, really, every baseball fan should go out there and get this book. It's to be part of your library.
Yeah, this is one that is going to be, you know, just referred to time and time again.
It's a reference book.
The stories that he has about each of the players.
Oh, yeah.
And to be able to rank the top 100 players in baseball history. And again, it's not just the MLB. I mean, he's got Sadahara Oh in the book, which we mentioned in the interview. One thing that we should mention, though, is we did this interview prior. I think you guys are going to know this. If you're listening to this now, you heard the interview. We did this prior to the Hall of Fame where the Veterans Committee and the committees voted. And he's talking, of course, about Buck O'Neill and the special relationship that they had. And we're talking about him, you know, hopefully getting into the Hall of Fame. Well, we all know now that he is in the Hall of Fame.
Well deserved.
Which we're glad. Yeah.
Well deserved. Yes. We're very happy that he's gotten into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. You know, it's bittersweet because now in the Hall of Fame, the last time, and as Posnanski was saying, he didn't take it. You know, he was thrilled that these 17 other guys got in.
Right.
But why couldn't he get in when he could enjoy it? I mean, it's
some things are unexplainable.
Right. But he was.
You just shake your head and you can't explain it.
He was a Hall of Famer then. But now all of a sudden they realize it. I guess, again, the same with Gil Hodges. They finally righted a wrong.
Right. And look, let's not take away from Tony Oliva, Jim Cott, Manny Minosa.
Right.
And Bud Fowler.
Of course. Right. Of course. I want the people to be able to, if it's at all possible, to be alive, to have that, you know, to the joy of it.
Yep.
But of course, Joe Posnanski is very happy. Bob Kendrick is very happy. You know, anyone that we unfortunately never got the chance to meet him. We didn't even get the chance to talk to him, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But everybody that knew him had such loving things to say about him.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all happy that he's in, and we're happy that he's in. Jeff, if people want to comment on that interview, if they want to wish us a happy holiday, a happy new year, how can they get in touch with the show?
They can email us at baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. You can tweet us at Baseball and BBQ. You can leave a comment on Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Our phone number is 516-855-8214. And our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please rate, review us, follow us, tell your friends. We want to grow this show. You know, we think we have a fun show, and we want to let everybody know about that.
And the people listening know we have a fun show. It's the people that aren't listening.
Yes.
You know, we spread the word.
Spread the word.
The next interview that we have, Jeff.
Chris Schaefer.
You guys are really going to enjoy Chris. What a great guy. And this interview was after he had worked a day. He looked exhausted, but he came alive.
The guy works hard. He works at the restaurant. He does competitions. We mentioned he's the world champion. Yeah, you guys are going to enjoy this interview.
So here he is. Chris Schaefer.
Chris Schaefer is the owner and pitmaster of Heavy Smoke BBQ in St. Peters, Missouri, a world champion competition barbecue team turned food truck catering company. They also have a restaurant located in St. Peters, Missouri. Chris is with us today to talk about all things barbecue and his experience at the 2021 KCBS Invitation Open World Championship. Welcome to Baseball and BBQ, Chris Schaefer.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having us, guys.
Welcome, Chris. I guess you froze when I said, when Jeff was talking about the competition, and I said, you kicked ass at that competition. Am I right?
Yeah, man. We had a really good day. You know, I didn't love to cook going into awards, actually. You know, I made a couple mistakes along the way, and I spent about 3 hours telling everybody that it was the worst cook of my life. And then I won the thing. So I had a lot of people mad at me that night.
It's like when Nolan Ryan is warming up in the bullpen, has nothing, and then pitches a no-hitter. That's what it's like.
No. It's like when Chris kicks ass at the competition.
Right.
Nolan Ryan can go, well, we want him on the podcast. So right. He can go just listen to something else for now.
Man, Nolan Ryan throws heat no matter what.
Yeah, exactly right.
So then, Jeff, ask him a question.
My question to you is, since St. Peter's is only about 30, 40 miles from St. Louis, are you a Cardinals fan?
Yeah, I'm a giant Cardinals fan.
Okay, there you go.
And we may have to talk some baseball, too.
But I haven't caught a game in a while. You know, I'm so busy, man. I just haven't got to watch too many of them. But, you know, if they're on, that's who I'm rooting for.
Right. Good organization.
You talk about being busy. All right,
yeah.
Chris.
Yeah.
You compete on the weekends. You run a restaurant all week. So start us at the beginning. What the heck were you thinking?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'm a glutton for punishment.
The reality is, like I said, I'm always trying to run a gun. I'm just like a busy guy in general, and I'm not great with idle hands. So yeah, I've always been super busy, and you know, I started competing a while back, and then yeah, I worked quite a bit and competed and got busier and busier and busier. Started the food truck, and then you know, obviously started the restaurant. So now I'm basically open to close at the restaurant like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I'll work from 5 a.m. to noon on Thursday and go home and trim my meat and make injections, do that type of stuff, and get the trailer loaded and head out somewhere, you know, Friday, Saturday, and sometimes Sunday to compete. And I'll be back on the pits of the restaurant at 5 a.m. on Monday. So I don't really stop.
Listen, all that free time he has. The guy's lazy. He's a lazy good nut. And I tell you, Jeff.
Well, to add on to it, I coach my daughter's softball team too. So I got practice once a week in games.
Wow.
We stay pretty busy.
But are they winning? That's what we want to know. Are they winning?
They won. They won about half their games.
All right, that's good.
There was a team in the league that was I don't know. I think half of them were like driving there. My daughter's only 8 years old, and they kind of trounced every team they played. So we didn't beat them.
All right. Well, you did okay. Go ahead, Jeff.
So you run a restaurant with, I guess, your wife Danielle and Chad Brew. Is he a friend of yours or just a business partner?
Yeah. So Chad, you know, we met, man, I was like 15 years old. You talk about always being busy. I was, one summer I was 15 and I was working in a harbor, actually, you know, cutting grass and doing things like that. And I would work all day and I'd go home and shower and I'd work in the restaurant all night doing dishes and stuff. So, you know, I started working there, you know, cooking in a restaurant. And then they brought Chad in as the kitchen manager when I was, I think I was maybe 17 and he was like 19. And we worked together all through high school and college and stayed best friends. And it got to a point, you know, he stayed in the industry. I went, you know, to college and come in the business world, but he was a kitchen manager and a chef of 20 some odd years. And he was working at a restaurant that was just kind of killing his soul. They were like, oh, let's cook all the ribs on Sunday and microwave them through the week. And it was just killing him, you know? And so I kind of went on a limb and said, let's start this food truck. And I did that for him. My wife left her job as a dental assistant. Chad and Danielle worked the food truck while I kind of ran the business and booked all the jobs and did the books and that kind of stuff. And, you know, when COVID hit, you know, we made a lot of our money parking in front of businesses and selling for lunches and stuff. And everybody went to work from home. And I never wanted to leave a good job to start a restaurant. So with COVID hitting, you know, kind of hurting the food truck, I ended up losing my job due to COVID. And we said, well, let's just, you know, start a restaurant during a global pandemic. Why not?
Yeah, that's it. The truck's not working, so let's.
Before you came on, you said you felt selling out, which is great.
Yeah, we're doing great. You know, we were so much busier out the gate from what we thought we were going to be, and we immediately had to pivot. I mean, we were 3 weeks in and we're like, whoa, like, you know, we got a problem here. We were selling out by like 2 p.m. every day and we opened 11. And so we were selling out by like 2 p.m. and trying to find ways to cook more food, and then ended up buying a couple more smokers to try to get ahead of it. I mean, it just took off so fast. We knew we had good food. You know, people love the food truck. We had a good following, and we knew if we could just get them in the front door that we'd keep them with our food and our quality of food, you know, but it took off quick, man. I think my first year projection, we hit like the third week of May. So I was very happy.
Nice. I was going to say about your competition team. I mean, I'm looking on your website, well, all those accolades you have, all those grand championships, team of the year, reserve grand champions. Wow, that's something to really be proud of.
Yeah, you know, we've been real successful. I always say I've been real lucky, but, you know, I started cooking, you know, 2011, 2012, and, you know, we're only doing 5-6 competitions a year. And at that time, I was cooking with a buddy of mine, just doing chicken on that team. And 2014, we had a scheduling conflict, and I decided to cook one on my own. And on that one, that very first one I cooked without my partner, I got reserve grand champion and never really went back. Honestly, like, I didn't plan on starting a team. So my buddy Cole, who got me into it and taught me everything, he used to always have this joke. People would say, how do you cook such great barbecue? And he would say, salt, pepper, and heavy smoke. And so I was going to cook one competition without him. And as an ode to him, I signed up under the team name Salt, Pepper, and Heavy Smoke. And before I sent it in, I was like, that's just too long. And I wish I still had that application, because I literally just drew a line through salt and pepper and competed as heavy smoke. And then we reserved it and never looked back. I'm just kind of I'm one of those guys that, like, anything I do, I'm all in. And so, you know, it's one of those things, like, if I wasn't out, you know, seeing some success, I probably wouldn't be doing. I'd probably go do something else.
Chris, are you cooking with your dad?
Yeah. So, you know, my first team, my brother-in-law, Jimmy, and a good buddy of mine, Danny, you know, they kind of, you know, were the ones that kind of told me to go out on my own. You know, they're like, man, you're cooking chicken. This other guy's team, you know, you're a good cook. You should try to do this thing. And so, you know, the first year they cooked with me. The second year, my brother-in-law, Jimmy, stayed on. And then my brother, Jeremy, cooked with me for 1 year. And then that was 2015. And in October, we seen, I got my first GC in October 15. And then in November of 15, we lost my brother, committed suicide. So after that, you know, my dad just started coming and hanging out. You know, he just wanted to spend some time with me. And I was cooking a lot of local comps. And so he would just come hang out and help where he could, but he was really just hanging out. And then I think it was maybe 17. My brother-in-law got real busy. His son was playing super competitive soccer. And so he was just hard to make a lot of the comps. And my dad just stepped in. And I think my dad's missed 2 comps out of our last maybe 180 comps. So it's me and my dad every weekend now. And I wouldn't have it any other way, man. We get to spend so much great time with each other that, you know, most fathers and sons don't get. So it's real cool.
That's nice. What are you, when you're out there competing, easy for me to say, what equipment are you using?
I'm a drum smoker. So cooking barrels over direct heat, hot and fast. You know, we get, you know, brisket and pork done in, you know, like 3-4 hours. And we actually get to sleep and get up and get stuff done in time and watch these other guys cook all night long. And, you know, they're dead tired and I'm wide awake. So it works for us.
Because you got all that driving to do.
Yeah, we travel a lot. We do travel a lot.
That 180 comps that you were saying, that's about how long? 180 is about 2 years, 2.5 years.
Nah, you know, so I cooked 46 this year.
Okay.
Last year, because of COVID, I only cooked 29. The year before that, I cooked 34, 35. The year before that, I cooked 30 something, you know, so.
Some of the guys do a lot more. Depends the area.
Yeah, so like live. This year, you know, 46 is a lot. You know, I think the most I've really seen everybody do is in the 50s. But, you know, you only got 52 weekends in a year. And living in the Midwest, you know, the Midwest competition's kind of shut down between November and March. So if you want to compete, you got to travel. And then obviously there's, you know, there's some doubles too. So you can get, you know, 2 in 1 weekend or something. But I mean, 46, you know, 46 this year was a lot for me.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true. There's only 52 weeks in a year. So
Yeah.
You know, they gotta rest sometime. We actually had a contest here. I don't know if they're still having it because of COVID, but it's a KCBS event. It's on Staten Island, and we went a couple of years. I think you would do quite well at that competition.
Yeah, when is that competition?
Well, it was
April, I think.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's. I don't know the last couple of years. I'm not even sure they had it.
Right. How far? Yeah, you know. I was going to say where's the farthest you traveled to do a competition?
I would say South Carolina. We went to South Carolina twice this year. And then next month, I'll be in Florida twice. So I think that's probably my furthest.
Wow. And you're driving from St. Louis down to.
Yeah.
That's quite a trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about 15 hours. You know, pulling a trailer and stops, it's probably more like 16, 16 and a half. But I'm going to try. They got the first weekend in January. There's one in Florida. I'm going to try to see if I can find a place to stash my trailer down there. That way I can drive back without pulling it and then go pick it back up for the second one that's in the last weekend of January. So try to do some things like that to save some miles and some fuel cost from, you know, a lot of travel.
Sure.
Jeff and I mean, I know we're probably known for, you know, the baseball and barbecue moniker as a cooking team. Now we're backyard cooks.
Yep.
So love watching the Pitmasters on TV and all of that. Loved when we went to the competition. That was great. But we are backyard cooks. So what's the best piece of advice that you could give to a backyard cook?
You know, the best thing I can tell you is to keep it simple. You know, I mean, I think too many people are trying to do too many crazy things. You know, there's people I see, you know, wrapping ribs with grape jelly and just doing, you know, weird things like that. You know, I think, you know, barbecue and grilling or cooking in general, because I got, you know, kind of a chefy type background, is it's really about cooking things properly. You know what I mean? Like, you figure out how to cook ribs to the perfect temperature every time. The flavor you put on it doesn't matter too much. You know what I mean? Like, put a little bit of a salt base down and then a good kind of all-purpose flavor, and then cook it right. And everyone's going to think it's the best thing they ever had.
And Chris, how are you dealing with, you didn't talk about a restaurant, you've been open a year, you had experience with the food truck, but now, of course, meat prices are rising. And how do you deal with that?
Well, you got to get creative. You know, we've had to raise prices a little bit here and there. Just it's kind of the nature of the beast. That's had to, you know, it's had to happen too. But, you know, getting creative, you know, if we have anything left over, we've got some things in our menu with my business partner, Chad, being a chef, we can do different things. And so, for example, we have egg rolls on our menu. And so we have like a brisket, and then we have a chicken Philly style egg roll. And if I got leftover brisket, I can put it in an egg roll. We have pork cakes, which is born out of my love of crab cakes. That is pulled pork and cream cheese and cheddar cheese. And we bread them in panko breadcrumbs and fry them and serve them with coleslaw on them. And, you know, we found ways to use leftovers for that type of stuff. But really, it's just, you know, trying to, you know, make sure you use everything and be creative.
Right. I'm looking at your menu now. I mean, you do have some different things. The St. Louis Cuban, I never heard of that. That sounds a little different.
Glutton. Yeah. So the Cuban, you know, I got married in Clearwater, Florida, and my business partner, Chad, was one of my groomsmen, you know, and we went down there to get everything done for the wedding. And man, I bet you we ate 10 Cuban sandwiches down there in the, you know, the 5 days we were there. Just love that sandwich. So we opened the food truck. You know, it was our idea to do something like that, but, you know, our own twist on it. So we still do our pulled pork and a pit ham, pickles, and a Provel cheese, which is a, you know, a St. Louis thing, and make a white horseradish sauce and put it in a tortilla and grill it. And that's been our number one seller since we started the food truck with the restaurant and everything. And the glutton was my brainchild. I always joked I wanted to make something that Guy Fieri would come try, you know. So, you know, that's tater tots and mac and cheese and brisket and a big old flour tortilla. And we deep fry that thing and cover it in queso. And we sell the heck out of those too.
That's great. I mean, besides brisket and pork and the chicken, have you gotten any unusual requests at your restaurant to cook? I mean, or what is the most unusual thing you ever barbecued?
Most unusual thing ever barbecued. It's kind of a tough one. We've cooked a lot of different things. you know, I've cooked alligator and, you know, different things like that. But I try to stick, you know, as kind of as traditional as possible. But in the restaurant, we get all kinds of crazy requests. So
do you? Do tell. Just,
you know, well, yesterday, for example, you know, obviously we bake our egg rolls ahead of time. And a lady asked if she could have egg rolls with the meat on the side. And I'm like, well, that's literally not possible. You know? So, you know, people will ask for anything. We do individual meals because of COVID. And so, you know, if somebody orders, yeah, 100 sandwiches, you know, we'll make 100 sandwiches and, you know, deliver it to them. And then obviously they'll sort it from there. And we had a lady today that wanted 150 individual meals and she wanted us to label them. She wants to put the people's name on them. And then she asked us to, if we could Starbucks. Package them up. Well, she asked if we could package them up in alphabetical orders to make it easier for her to hand them out. And I was like, man, I'm pretty accommodating, but that's just not going to happen.
Right.
I'm sorry. Lisa, yeah. I'm good at alphabetizing things. I'll take that job.
I was going to say there's half my cooks that I think they'd need help needing that, getting that done.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, well, you know, we have to have an episode and call it like, you know, just the funniest things. Yeah. Things in the restaurant industry. Wow.
I've always wanted to start a blog called How to Barbecue Wrong, like Malcolm Reed's How to Barbecue Right, but How to Barbecue Wrong, right. and just be nothing but fail stories, you know.
Uh-huh. Oh, I should tell them about my story about the ribs.
Yeah,
I hung ribs in my pit barrel, and they were extremely tender. So I thought, oh, if I leave them on longer, they'll be more tender. I go in, run in, and take a shower to get, you know, the smoke off. I come out, billows of smoke coming out of the pit barrel. And I open it up, and there's the hook with like a little piece of meat on it.
And the ribs are in the firebox.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so I would be on that. I would be on that show.
Oh, no, I mean, I can tell you funny fail stories all day. I went to a competition and I used to pre-mix all my rubs. Now, you know, I've got my own rubs on the market. So obviously it's easier to open a bottle and shake it on. But I used to pre-mix them all and I had them in containers. And we hit a bump or something and knocked over the container and I spilled like 90% of my pork rub. So, you know, the day of the comp, we rub with what we have and go to put it on. And my brother-in-law put the actual grill grate in the smoker wrong. So as soon as I put the pork butt on, the grill grate flipped and the pork butt fell dead into the firebox. And so I scoop it out, take it inside and wash it off. But now I'm out of pork rub because I spilled it all. And so I just took my rib rub and put it all over it and threw it back on. And that pork got a perfect, perfect score, and we won the comp.
I knew that was coming.
So, I mean, a perfect's one thing, but to get a perfect, perfect with a pork butt that was in a firebox 5 hours ago was pretty ridiculous.
That's great.
And now he's got to do that every time.
Exactly, right?
You know, I haven't tried that since. I was actually wrapping brisket at a comp, and my nephew dropped his Mountain Dew and spilled Mountain Dew all in my brisket wrap. And I'm like, oh, what am I going to do now? So I wrapped it up and I got third place brisket and reserved that comp. And I haven't tried that yet either. They're trying it again.
So, you know, Len, not only does Chris have a food truck, not only has a restaurant, not only a world champion, he also has also makes his own rubs, which he has for sale on his website, but also you teach classes, right?
Yep. I teach classes. You know, we just had one this past weekend in St. Louis, and I'm doing one in January in Colorado. And then I got one. I'm teaming up with my buddy Richard Fergola from Fergalicious, and we're doing one in Kansas City in February.
Nice.
Let's go back to the rubs.
Something else you probably didn't find on my website. I've also got a podcast.
You do?
I heard through the grapevine about that. But, you know, we only acknowledge podcasts that invite us to be on.
I'm going to ask, what's the name of your podcast?
Well, I'll tell you that in a second. We haven't recorded one in probably 6 months because I got so busy that.
You don't have time for a podcast.
It's the first thing
for you.
It's the first thing to back burner. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
I'm not going to hold off the restaurant. I'm not going to skip a comp. I'm not going to tell my daughter I can't go to her game. I'm just going to not do the podcast. But the name of the podcast. So, you guys are familiar with Competition Barbecue. We worked so hard. We worked so hard to get all this meat perfect. And then we put six little pieces in a box and we send it to some strangers and hope they tell us that they don't hate it. Right. That's kind of how competition goes. So, you know, our podcast is very competition focused. And so the name of it is All That for Six Pieces. So,
That's very good.
Yes.
Yeah. Six That's perfect. Actually. I like it.
Well, yeah, I had a buddy say that one time, my buddy Danny that used to cook with me when I first started heavy smoke is, you know, like, I think it's maybe his first competition. We get all this done and I slide it in the box and he literally was like, All That for Six Pieces. And I'm like, what? He's like, you just give them six pieces. I'm like, yeah. And, you know, he's looking at 6 pounds of brisket over there that was going to go in a cooler or whatever. And he's like, you did all that for six pieces, you know?
And ribs, you have like all those and you just get the most perfect, right? So,
well, yeah, I cook 4 racks of ribs and turn in usually 8 bones. And so, okay. I've always got a big old bag of ribs that one of my neighbors gets and they love it.
Now you have the two rubs, heavy smoke black label rub and heavy smoke white label rub. So I was going to ask you the difference between the two, and please don't be a wise guy and say the color. Okay.
Yeah. So I'll tell you how they got the name too. So the black label is designed for brisket, right? And it's a little saltier. It's good on a lot of stuff. Anything you do, like just a pop of flavor, like at the restaurant, we season our mac and cheese with it and we put on our wings and we season our chips with it and stuff like that. So anything needs a pop, you know, we put the black label on. But you know, I struggled with finding a name because there's already so many names out there. And I just kept thinking black label beef is what I was thinking. Right. And so my buddy Cole that I, you know, my first team, the guy that got me into it, I was talking to him and I was like, man, I just can't get off the name black label, you know? And he's like, well, what are you going to call the other one? I was like, well, I don't know, really. He's like, well, what is it? I was like, it's kind of all purpose. He's like, what do you put it on? I go, chicken, pork, you know, fish, you know, all that. And he goes, all the white meats. And I said, pretty much. And he's like, well, I think you got a white label. And I was like, dang, you're right. So we went with black label and white label. So white label is kind of more all purpose. It's sweeter and it's got a little kick of heat to it. They're actually really good together, you know? So if you want like a base layer of salt with the black label, like on ribs, and a heavier label, the white label over top of it, they're really good together. But I use them on all four meats and competitions. And I got to tell you, man, there's not many better feeling than opening the seal to your own bottle and putting it on meat and getting trophies. You know, it's pretty cool.
That is wild.
That is pretty cool.
Chris, I got one more for you. Well, who knows? I may have more than one.
That's fine.
Don't hold me to that. We're having a great time. So,
yeah,
you know, people should know this is the craziest podcast. I mean, Chris froze a couple of times. The intro we've got to keep because it's great. But yeah. Jeff's dog barked. Jeff ran to the door. Then my dog barked and I'm alone. So that's why I had to run out. So I just pulled back the curtain. But Chris,
we should show him the video.
this is one of the funniest ones we've ever done. And Chris, you have been unbelievable. So I'm so glad you're the guest. But I got a question now. We'll go back to the podcast. So believe it or not, Jeff and I are about to celebrate 4 years, our 4-year anniversary of doing this podcast. Now, you've been doing the podcast. Well, you haven't done one and you said 6 months. And of course, life gets in the way. But you realize how difficult it is. Now, I would assume that with Competition Barbecue, your guests are your listeners.
Yeah. I mean, my guests are my listeners, but I think what makes it a really good show is that my guests are my friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you listen to the show, like how it kind of happened, I have my buddy, my co-host is Rob Honke. His team name is St. Louis Black Iron, and he already had a podcast, and his podcast is like, if you want to listen to a roller coaster of a podcast, his is called Stampeding of Cattle. And it will literally go from politics to movies, to sports, to drugs and back. And it's like, I mean, it is a roller coaster, man. They just talk about anything. So when COVID hit, we just got real bored and we had no competitions for a few months and he had all the equipment. And I was like, man, I said, I think there's a space out there for a barbecue podcast. that sounds like guys sitting around at a competition, because that's what we always did, man. We just sit around a fire, you know, once everything's prepped and everything on Friday night, we just sit around a fire and we all just BS and make fun of each other and tell stories. Right. And we were like, we want something that has that kind of feel. And with being in competition barbecue as long as I have, it's easy to just to like text my buddies and be like, "Do you want to come on this thing?" You know? So right off the bat, you know, we have like Brad Leininger and, you know, Tim Shear and Darren Worth and Travis Clark and all these Joe Pierce, you know, these guys that we see every weekend and they come on, but you can tell by listening to the show that they're friends of ours and that we have a good rapport and we like BS, you know, and it's not so stuffy. I'll do a lot of research and have a lot of facts and I'll have an outline and then we don't talk about any of it, you know?
Those are the best ones where you go off script and, you know, there's just, you have the repartee between you and your guests. That's fantastic.
Well, and so I think a big miss, and obviously, you know, you guys know this well and you've got to figure it out. I think a big miss in a lot of podcasts is that, you know, they don't go after like these nuggets of gold that sometimes listeners give them, you know, and they're not listeners, guests. I remember we were talking to Bill Purvis with Chicken Fried Barbecue, and he just like offhanded comment mentioned big game hunting in Africa. And I was like, forget barbecue. We are now talking about big game hunting in Africa. You know, Richard Fergola with Fergalicious, you know, he was a, like a national champion coach, collegiate wrestler. And if you go listen to his podcast, we literally talk about wrestling and MMA for 23 minutes before we even mention barbecue, you know? And, I think that's what makes people want to listen, is that it's not just, hey, tell me about your first comp. It's
right.
It's true talk, you know?
So then the question is, Chris, what did we miss with you?
I don't know, man. I mean,
I think we got everything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, I do all kinds of stuff, but I mean, barbecue is my life now. I mean, it's cool. You know, people say like, oh, you're living the dream. And I'm like, man, I didn't know my dream included 16-hour work days for half the pay I used to make, you know, but it's reality, man. I love it. I wouldn't change anything.
It's a family affair. Your wife's involved with the restaurant. Your daughter has a section on the menu. I see.
She does, man. You know, I wanted to make it personal. I wanted, you know, when people come in, I wanted to feel like a family, you know? So we named the kids' menu Peyton Picks after my daughter. And then if you notice, there's a Pops plate. So we got our big plate that feeds 6 to 8 people. It's got a little bit of everything on there. And when I was trying to find a name for that thing, I decided why not name it after my dad. So I call my dad Pop. Everybody in the circuit calls him Pop or Pops, you know, and he's one of the most loved guys in barbecue. And that's one of the true wins to me. And what we've done is how much everybody loves my dad.
That's fantastic. Before we wrap, we want to give you a chance to give us your social media. And I got to tell you that your Heavy Smoke Barbecue restaurant now has now just got onto my bucket list. So whenever I get to St. Louis, because I got to catch a Cardinals game one of these days. I haven't been to St. Louis Busch Stadium yet. So I got to go there and then go to your restaurant for dinner. But tell us your social media and how people can get in touch with you.
You have to let me know when you come in, man. Well, I'll give you the VIP treatment. Maybe I'll go to that Cards game with you.
You know? Got it.
But on Facebook, it's Heavy Smoke BBQ. Instagram's Heavy Smoke BBQ. The website's heavysmokebbq.com. You know, that's really it. You know, the website's big. You know, you can see the menu. You can see, you know, pictures of events. You can see competition accolades. You can order our rubs and do all that. So that's it. You know, I'm pretty big on Facebook. You know, I'm always posting specials and posting things like that. So we're a pretty good follow.
Yeah, absolutely. Also on the website, I just want to mention you have your class. So if anybody's interested, go to the class tab there. You can sign up for your next class, which I think you said, what's Colorado?
Yeah, that was in Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, wait. Yeah,
I was going to say it kind of fell into my lap. A guy out there was wanting to kind of build barbecue in Colorado and just sent me a message and asked if I would want to do it. He had a place to do it. And oddly enough, it was about 30 minutes from where my sister-in-law lives. So I can go drop my wife and daughter off with, you know, her sister and go do a class with my pops and pick them up and head back home. So it kind of worked.
You know, that's great. Totally lost my train of thought.
I do that a lot, man.
I got it. Now I got it. I know Chris is a big Cardinals fan. He mentioned favorite Cardinal.
Yadier Molina.
He's going to Hall of Fame.
He's just a beast behind the plate. Nobody tries to steal on Yadi, and he's been here doing it his entire career. you know, after that, you know, Pujols was the man. Love Chris Carpenter, love Adam Wainwright. You know, I'm young enough that I'm not saying like Sam Usual and Lou Brock, you know, you get to watch those guys play. Those guys play or anything. I know Ozzie Smith was fun when I was pretty young. You know, he was out there doing his thing. But man, Molina's just—he's just a guy.
Yeah, he is amazing. He's been doing it for so long. Well, he's pushing 40 now. He's been doing it, and he's still one of the best. Still one of the best. Still can throw guys out. Still can hit the ball. I'll never forget that home run he hit against the Mets in the playoffs. So you know, I got to live with that. And Wainwright throwing that curveball to Carlos Beltran. I'll never forget that. But but St. Louis, they're always in it, Len. They're always in it.
Yeah, always.
They have great fantastic. Fans. Great fans of St. Louis. Yeah. And I can't wait to get there one of these days. It's one of the stadiums I got to get to.
Hey, let me know when you guys come in, man. We'll have a good time.
Great.
Excellent. What I wanted to ask you was, you mentioned Pujols. Your opinion, your feeling by Pujols going to the Angels, did he tarnish his career with St. Louis fans?
No, I mean, I think he was one of the best when he left us. And if he would have retired right then, he would have still been one of the best. And he's gone on to still do some pretty big things. And he wasn't, you know, he hasn't really been the St. Louis Pujols since he's left, but he's still a hell of a ball player, man. And, you know, I was one of those guys that didn't think we needed to pay for him, you know, and I was okay with him leaving. I thought that the price was too high. But I still like the guy, man. I mean, the things he did in St. Louis was crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. First ballot, walk-in Hall of Famer. He was one of the best, absolutely.
Right, but hold on. Outside of St. Louis, the stadium, right? Okay. There's a statue of Stan Musial, right? Am I correct on that?
Yep. Okay.
If Pujols had stayed Cardinal, would he have a statue eventually?
Man, probably.
But he doesn't, you know, now, right?
He's not going to. You know, I don't think it made a lot of sense for him to stay without us having the DH position. You know what I mean? I think he got up in age, and I think, you know, I think he needed to go to a place where he could play DH some, you know. And I don't think it was ever a good fit for him to stay long term with us at the end of his career there, especially at that price tag.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy night. And I know you must be tired after working all day, so we appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us. Best of luck at the restaurant, and one of these days we'll get out to St. Louis.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks,
Chris.
Thanks guys. Have a good night.
And, Len, I think once we get to St. Louis, we'll take Chris on his offer, and we'll go to a game and hit the Heavy Smoke Barbecue for dinner one night.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Well, Jeff, of course, we're going to take a free meal. No,
of course.
No, but we would love to hang out with Chris, and maybe he'll let us cook with him.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. That'll be the night the Department of Health closes him down.
Yeah.
No, but that was so much fun. Chris was such a good sport. You guys, again, that video, I mean, Jeff's letting his dog out. I'm running to let my dog out. Chris is freezing, you know, his internet's freezing. I mean, it was just, and yet we did it.
We got through it.
Yeah. This is the Christmas Day episode. It's being released on Christmas Day. So obviously everyone has done their shopping, but you know what? If you guys have gifts that you return or gift cards or who knows what that you forgot to get someone something or you, whatever it is, go to the Pandemic Baseball Book Club, books, various swag. Fifthandcherry.com is also great for your cutting boards. By the way, congratulations to Tim Razor and his wife and their family. They had a baby, and congratulations to them. And then, of course, there is baseballbbq.com, which is a wonderful supporter of our show. Mike Mullen, Brett Mandel, we appreciate them immensely. Guys, check them all out. And Jeff, how do we end the show?
We ended it today with Ace and Bobo, written by
the musician, Dave Dresser, the poet, Shel Krakowski. We wish you all
a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Kwanzaa, Hanukkah's happened. And for all your Seinfeld fans, Happy Festivus.
Bye, everyone.
Is
Christmas.